Today is the 6th of July 2024, and the time is 4 p.m. My name is Preeti Sri Venkatram, and I'm recording the second session of an interview with Dr. Shomita Mukherjee for the Making of Indian Conservation Project. I'm currently in Bangalore, and she is in Coimbatore. Thank you, Ms. Mukherjee, for the second session. And we could pick up from where we stopped last time, and at that point, I was asking about your reflections on successes and failures of conservation in India. And being a woman scientist in this field, there were two aspects that I was keen to hear your reflections on. One is the role of science in conservation, and the other was the role of women. We could probably start with the first one. And last time when we had stopped the conversation, there was something regarding molecular data that you were wanting to speak about. So maybe we could start there.
Sure, yeah. I learned all my molecular techniques, the molecular techniques in Dr. Uma Ramakrishnan's lab at NCBS. And that kind of opened out my world and how to study cryptic small species, you know, especially I was looking at carnivorous cats. So it just gave me such a better hold on. So until then, I used to get data that was really meager. Not that I get a lot of data now. I still get really meager data, but it's still a lot. And it does help in understanding the species much better, maybe at a different level. Mm-hmm. But it kind of opens your world out to different questions, to different kinds of questions, which were not possible to answer earlier. For instance, are populations connected? You know, have they, you know, we keep talking about bottlenecks. We even spoke about them in the past, you know, saying, oh, there's inbreeding, there could be inbreeding, there could be, you know, small populations have larger threats because they're small. And it's now with the advance in technology that we apply in this field, you can actually demonstrate it. Or you can even measure to what extent some threats have affected species. You know, for instance, even the tiger work that is done in Uma's lab, which really gave us a far, far wider range of issues that we could look at just looking at tiger conservation, you know. And apart from that, things like, you know, I worked on the species called the forest owlet, which is endemic to India. It's found in just a few small pockets in a zone in central India. That is, central India, I mean, as the whole wide region, like Maharashtra, Gujarat, Madhya Pradesh. Okay? And when we began, I did this work with Dr. Robin Vijayan from ISAC Tirupati and my colleague, Dr. Jayapal Raja. And when we began this project, you know, it was not clear whether the forest owlet, where it fitted in that owl tree, in the phylogenetic tree. Okay, because based on its appearance and osteology, that is bone structure, morphology, and osteology, they had placed it under its own genus called Heteroglox. Okay, but earlier scientists or, you know, naturalists had placed it under the genus Athene, which is, you know, the same genus as our spotted owlet. Yeah. So there was this this dilemma, where does it fit in? Now you may think this doesn't, you know, so what? It's just, actually it's just semantics. Like we are the ones binning it over here or there. But this does tell you about relationships between species, right? So the only way you could really address it is through a large amount of genetic data. And that's what we did. So we got permits to catch the forest owlet in, so we got one owlet in Madhya Pradesh, and we took blood samples and we resolved its phylogeny. Now, why is it important? Is that when you decide on conservation measures, okay, or when you decide on conservation, okay, as such, you have to prioritize species that you want to conserve. Okay, now it makes a big difference if a species, of course, this has all the other things going for it as a priority species because it's found in such a small area overall globally. It's found only in India. It's found only in the central part of India, and that too in little pockets. That itself says, of course, we have to prioritize the species. But beyond that, if it is the only, if it is a species that belongs to the only genera, okay, like Heteroglox, there's no other species that belongs to that genus, okay? It's a standalone genus and species. Then, of course, it kind of brings it up, you know, it's a unique thing. But of what we found is that it is very closely related to the Ethini group, but it is at the base of the Ethini group. Okay, so again, because it's at the base, that is, it kind of diversified earlier than the rest. Should we call it Heteroglox or should we call it Ethini? Now, that is a, you know, I mean, it's whatever. We called it Ethini. So it still belongs to that group, but it is unique. It's unique in many, many different ways. And this information, genetics provided. Now, the other thing to go forward, which we had planned to do, but we couldn't do because, you know, there was a COVID outbreak and then we didn't have enough time left after that to finish our work and to get permits from different states is often difficult. So we couldn't answer the question whether these pockets of populations are connected or not. And that is of vital conservation importance. Are they fragmented populations or are they connected populations genetically? But that can be answered using genetics. So, and that has been done to quite an extent with the tigers, right? I mean, they are really studied very, very well because of the whole lot of money that comes in for tiger conservation, as well as, you know, people who are interested in it. But similarly, you could do this for several other taxa groups to see, even to see whether whether humans have really affected species to what extent. You know, just our activities, have they reduced the diversity, the genetic diversity of species? Have they fragmented populations? All this can be answered using genetic data.
How do you see the place of scientific knowledge vis-a-vis informal or experiential knowledge when it comes to conservation?
Well, I think it's extremely important. It's extremely important, especially for small, for, you know, species you do not have enough information on. And I think in specific areas, because just like humans behave differently depending on the situation or depending on the conditions in an area, even animals do the same thing. So there are lots of you know, one-time records or a few records that you cannot really publish. Maybe there's behavioral observations, maybe it is just, you know, diet, or there's just too meager information that you cannot really, but that does count. And I found this to be really important, especially when you're preparing the red list for the IUCN red list, because knowledge really, because for many of these cats, you really have very, very little information. Not many people are studying them. They're too cryptic, they are rare. But there will be somebody who had some observations, who has some information, but not really enough to publish. And that really counts. Especially, you know, when you're looking at threats, like even talking to people, right? I mean, those are like, if you like, when you're talking to hunters, say, people who are hunting, I mean, you get a whole lot of knowledge which is not published. It's just personal experiences or whatever. what happens is now with technology, say like even just look at camera trapping, okay? And it's a technology that has like very rapidly spread in the ecological community, especially those studying mammals. And it's been used very, very widely. Almost anybody can buy camera traps and set them up and, get information. But how you interpret that information is really important. It's like science is not just about technology. It's about the kind of questions you ask. I mean, or the question, how do you address? The question can be anything. It can be very simple. It doesn't have to be, it can just be, why is this flower red and this flower white or whatever, It's how you address it, the kind of tools you use, and then how you interpret your data. And I think that interpretation of your data is really, really important, because I may get the same result that you have, but we may interpret it totally differently. And that can have, I think sometimes it could have large consequences on how you interpret your results. And that, I think, depends on experience. It depends on, for the longest time, people used to call the jungle cat, even now, a generalist species, for instance. Okay, why? Because it is found everywhere. Wherever they put camera traps, jungle cat is very common. Okay, and so they say, because it is common, it is generalist. Well, that's not so. You can be common simply because the habitat that you specialize in is very widespread. So if a species that specializes in open habitats, okay, in a certain part of the country is very widespread and common, you don't call it a generalist. You have to look at it from an ecological perspective. Just numbers don't make something common or don't make it a specialist or a generalist. They make it common or rare. But usually people just say, oh, it's very common, it's a generalist. Okay, and I think there's a danger in that, because then when these habitats are disturbed or threatened, okay, even an animal that is very common can actually take a very bad beating. Depending on how you change the habitat. So I would be really, of course, generalist, specialist, again, it's something on a spectrum. It's not either end, but relatively speaking, so I think these are things you have to take care of, and that's where personal information or knowledge or information on the natural history or just observing things about a species that otherwise go unnoticed, especially when you rely so much rely on, when you prioritize the technology rather than the ecology of the species. So a lot of people, again, like I said, camera trapping has become so common. Everybody has, you can put up a camera, you can put up camera traps anywhere. Anybody can do it. Again, coming back to cats, I will give you examples of that because I'm familiar with that. So if you look at even the body structure of cats, okay, they all look more or less similar. You can tell a cat easily from any other group of animals. But if you look at it more carefully, if you look at the open area living, cats that live in open areas, whether you look at the caracal, whether you look at the jungle cat, whether you look at the serval, and even if you look at the wild cat, they have longish legs. And they don't have, like, some of them have really short tails. Okay. Some of them have, they don't have these really long tails like you would have in cats that live in the forest that go up the tree. Okay. So these morphological differences also indicate to you the kind of habitats they use. So, which I think that that kind of what would you say, observations or interpretations or whatever you would like to call it, descriptions, descriptive whatever is somehow not looked at or not dwelled upon in this whatever when you have where you get a lot of camera traps, you get a lot of data, you only look at the numbers and the figures, you don't look at the species and the life history stuff that goes with the species. So I think it's important. I mean, I tell my students that, that become a cat and you see what it is like. Like you put yourself in that, put yourself in the place of a jungle cat with tall legs or a rusty spotted cat that is really tiny and then,
How do you see the role of women in the past, say, 50 odd years of the conservation journey in our country?
Oh, amazing, because it was very surprising, even being at the Wildlife Institute, even back then, that was in the 80s and late 80s and early 90s, that there were so many women in the field even then. We were almost like 40% of the entire whatever, I mean, at any point if you look at. We were surprised to see so many women in the field. And after that, some of our colleagues who joined us, we were doing our masters, and there were others who came in as PhD students. They became faculty, and then slowly the numbers. Now it is, I mean, I think at the faculty level or at the higher senior position level, they're still lower than what you would expect given a pool of, given the pool of women, generally speaking. I don't know what happens to them, where they go, or although I think there are institutes, like when I joined SACON, I was the only woman faculty. When I joined, there was Dr. Lalitha Vijayan before me, but she retired soon after I joined. So then again, for the longest time, I was the only woman. Like she was the only woman then. Now there are two more women colleagues. Okay, that's still very little, but it's, but I think my colleagues have also changed a lot since women have joined the faculty. I think it helps balance out even just the thought processes. The way we think, I think, are very different. Vis-a-vis, I mean, just not just your relations with your students, but even many other things, and I think it having men and women kind of balance out these certain things. And I don't know, I'm sure it helps the institute on the whole, especially for students. It is really important that the women students, it's really important that they have women mentors or faculty or somebody, not necessarily mentors, but just somebody who they can go to and talk to about any situation or any problem that they face. But otherwise, yes, I think there is quite a lot of change now in the number of women contributing to conservation. And it's good to know it's one field that was kind of filled up really fast with women. Something that's unexpected in a field like ours, right? Because it requires you to go and stay in remote areas for long periods where you won't have any female colleagues along with you. And it can be really tough. So I think things have changed. And also, I think when I joined, the women who had joined were again from The more, what would you say, obviously not from conservative families, right? But I think things have changed now. It's not looked at as a field where women cannot work or shouldn't work.
How do you
Like,
think that change came about?
I guess the world changed quite a bit. I mean, society is evolved, or I would say evolved. And I think also there is more empowerment and even agency for women, which wasn't there back then. Like just the power, the act, the POSH Act, the Prevention of Whatever Sexual Harassment at the Workplace Act itself, I think has given women a lot of confidence and even seeing other women around you who are doing what they want to has helped a lot, I think. I would yeah.
Yeah. Are there any? Sorry.
When I wanted to join this course, the first thing parents would ask is, oh, how many women are there in the field, how many women are there, or I don't think those are the kind of questions that parents ask anymore. Okay, women are allowed to just choose what they want to, which is really good. Of course, not everywhere, but it has expanded.
And are there any aspects in particular you would say are or have been a failure to the inclusion of women in conservation?
Oh, no, I don't think they. Oh, you mean have some things not really met the expectations for women? Yeah, I think this whole the sexual harassment thing is just still so prominent, and it is so hidden in many ways. I think women still feel, oh, should I, was this really that bad? Should I take it as something more serious and complain? That's one thing. The men, I think, have not really changed too much. Okay, they many of them still are, so they may not do something because they're scared of doing it, which is good enough to some extent, but it's not good because the minute that fear is removed, they will again go back to, like for instance, they won't say things in front of women who they kind of are wary of saying things to, but they would say it if the woman is not around. So that hasn't really changed, right? So
Is
I
there
think
any conservation specific example when you're saying this?
I mean, you mean I mean not directly related to conservation, but related to women in the field of conservation. Conservation specific, I don't know. I mean, I think a sociologist or somebody working in those whatever will be able to talk about it better, or an anthropologist or something, whether how things have changed in the field of conservation because of women, as in, I'm just talking about human relations within the group of ecologists or within just even given my or whatever in my institution. So I think it'll take a long time for men to change, because I think the drive was from women, that we wanted a change, I suppose, women as women in the whole. Obviously, sexual harassment was something that women wanted to end. Yeah. Obviously, the push was from the women, and the men now feel defensive.
What is your vision for the future of conservation in India?
Oh my God, that's a very big question. Mainly because of my personality, maybe I don't really think so much into the future. It's sometimes really dismal, right? So, yeah, I don't know. As far as at least as far as science is concerned, of course the future is looks bright, of technology, but I don't know if we are addressing conservation issues at the same pace that we are getting data. So, because nothing, the thing is, conservation doesn't just end at science, right? I mean, it has to get into the larger picture. I'm not a conservationist in that way because I've never really done any conservation science, or I've never really done stuff. I just am an ecologist. And I don't see anywhere where my work has really helped directly in conservation. Indirectly, yes, it talks about we've got better information on threats, maybe, or you know, or diet or something or something, but it's not really gone into on the ground in many ways. Yeah. So there may be projects. Oh yeah, there are many more projects on small cats, but that doesn't really mean it has helped them on the ground. We still don't know whether it has or not. But there are other people who are doing great work. I mean, they have, but there are very few, really few, who are actually working on the ground. And again, if it's just small groups or individuals doing the work, it only affects those really tiny areas. Okay, there. So I don't know. It's a mixed bag. I mean, you feel good when you see people doing stuff that, you know, something that way. Oh, I would also have liked to do something like this. Okay.
What are some ways that you perhaps think that ecology could directly influence conservation? Or things like you're saying that you wish it was something you were doing. Could you maybe give some examples?
Yeah, wish I was doing also be, it's like it's an it's not it's like I don't know if I mentioned last time, it's like, you know, conservation today I did something and it worked and it's doing fine. Just the next week it can just collapse. So I don't know, you feel completely out of control when it goes there in those directions. Okay, so sorry, what was the question you asked? Whether there were
Whether
any.
you see that there are ways that ecology could play a more
I.
direct role in influencing conservation than at present, if you think you would like to include.
You know, there is tremendous potential. There's tremendous potential, but they are not listening. That's the problem.
Is there any, like, in terms of your ideal world, what would conservation in your ideal world look like?
I think it would look like it would the science that we do, okay, would be incorporated into policies to a much, much larger extent, where we would be the ones who would be consulted So in my ideal world, we would have ecology at the center, whether it's ecology, human ecology, urban ecology, natural, whatever, ecosystems, that kind of an ecology, the ecology we do. But everywhere you would consider that, because that's the only science that talks about effects of a certain activity, right? In our natural world, the space that we live in. That's ecology, right? How you interact with things around you. And until you take that into consideration in your policies, it's not going to work. I don't know if I'm clear. I'm not really articulating it too well, but yeah, in my ideal world, I think ecology would be at the center of making policies. Okay, and by ecology, that's what people mistake. They say, "Oh, you mean your cats have to be the most important?" No, obviously not. But yes, the natural world has to be the most important. Because that's where all your resources come from. That's where you can't abuse it and then expect to carry on. We are part of it. So you have to take care of that. And I think in my ideal world, there would be a lot of monitoring that happens around every activity to see whether we are going in the right direction or do we have to change course. So, for instance, if you do have windmills coming up in an area, which then you find with your science or with your research or with your observations and with the local people's economies, you find that this is not working, then you change course. Another thing is, I think also in my ideal world, the message of conservation or the insights we get from observations, from talking to people, from science, She would spread amongst a much larger group of people. I'm guilty of not really writing or popularizing my work because I'm so caught up. So
In
you have,
addition to writing, do you think there could be other ways as well?
of course, I think just going and going back and meeting the people where you have worked and talking to them, talking to children, talking to which a lot of it, I guess we do while we are in field as well, but it doesn't, it's not formally done, so it doesn't. I think to some extent, maybe if it's done in a formal way, it people may have a larger memory or greater whatever association with it or whatever, and gives it more importance.
Coming towards the end of this interview, I want to ask how you foresee the future of wild species and spaces in India. What gives you worry? What gives you hope? I feel you've covered quite a bit about what gives you worry, but
Yeah.
maybe if you could just take a few moments to reflect on what do you think is actually going to happen and if there's anything that gives you hope.
Yeah. So, like I said, it's very difficult to say whether. So, what gives me hope is definitely that the field of ecology, okay, as a science, is has become far, far more popular. Now there are many, many more people who, young people who want to get into this field. So we do have a lot of people who, but they're not really very. I think they, of course, some of them are very sure of what it is that they want to come into this field for. Many aren't, but basically the message is spreading. Okay, that's one thing that gives hope. That our group is getting larger. There are more people like us now. And what was the other thing you asked? What would
How do you foresee the future when it comes to wild species and spaces of our country?
I feel sad. I feel depressed, frankly. I really don't know. I don't know what to make of it because it's too large a question, and wherever, whatever I have seen, very limited knowledge, of course, because it's just my individual whatever perceptions. I don't know whether it's because we have more information that we now realize how terrible the situation is in many cases. Except for just a few pockets of areas where, which will also go as the human population increases. So I really don't know. I don't know about hope for the future. I just find it also, I don't know whether it's just the news feeds that you get are also about their news tends to be alarming, right? Often, like I think most of the news that we get or that we read or that we hear is more, I would say, negative in the sense of, oh, this many, whatever, this many hectares of forests are gone, or this species is, the populations are declining, or, whatever. It's been like that ever since I have joined. So I don't know. I don't know what to say about hope, except that many more people are joining the this field of ecology in terms of science. Yes, there is hope. And also that they are more interested in a diverse set of taxa, not just the larger so-called charismatic species. But yeah, when you ask about hope and whatever, it also depends on
Money.
when. ask me. No, all yeah, money of course for conservation,
Oh no,
but
sorry, I
also
said worry.
worry.
Yeah, what gives you hope and what gives you worries?
Yeah, so of course there is a lot of worry, much more worry than hope.
Okay.
But I don't know. It's something I cannot just answer. It also depends. Maybe my answer will change. Maybe on a particular day when I'm feeling really great and whatever, I will probably say
Hopeful.
something else. But I don't think it'll change that much, my answer. Because, I mean, isn't that what we really discuss amongst ourselves all the time? I mean, even if you listen, you go to any conference, and apart from the excitement of new information and new technology and new applications, the general message is that things are not going that great. So,
Were you wanting to say something about money?
no. Oh, yeah, I meant money as in money that is fueled into conservation.
Before we end this session, I want to ask if there's anything related to your personal journey that we haven't spoken about that you would like to reflect on, or even regarding conservation, any topic or issue that we haven't covered but you would like to add?
No, not that I can think of anything. I think, yeah, I think the last time I spoke a lot about myself, so that
Okay. And
was
anything about conservation that you think hasn't been covered in the questions till now, but is something you would like to speak about?
no, nothing that I can think of
Okay. Fine.
doing. Yeah.
Then I can stop the recording.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for both the sessions. It was lovely speaking with you.
It was nice for me too.